deepest, darkest crypts, to the backwoods swamp where you hit the bottom, from the inside of your casket to the fears lodged deep inside your subconscious. It's time for the Big Scary Show.
ChristopherSylvia.com, and you're listening to The Big Scary Show.
This is Lori.
And this is Steve-O from the Garage of Evil Network, and you're listening to The Big Scary Show at BigScaryShow.com.
Oh, you could say Garage of Evil Network.com, too.
I don't have to.
Hi, this is Rex Hamilton, world-famous haunted house actor, and you are listening to The Big Scary Show.
This week, on a very special Big Scary Show, the eyes of the haunt community turn towards Columbus, Ohio, for the Midwest Haunters Convention, and all four hosts of The Big Scary Show are there, on location. Because of that, we're going to bring you a slightly different show. Storm will still have its haunt minute and rant on. The haunt rocker will still play the dark and menacing tunes. Badger does read the news. And the unknown scare actor does invite you to face your fears. There's no round table this week, but we are planning something so spectacular. You'll just have to tune in to the next few shows to find out what it is. Because there's no roundtable, we're going to bring you a series of classic interviews Badger did at the Mad Monster Party this past spring. We bring you interviews from the Tall Man, Jack Skellington, and the most famous movie villain of all time. So kick back. Turn up that computer, download the show, and enjoy this very special episode of The Big Scary Show.
Here come the mummies, creeping on The Big Scary Show.
The door, I stared across the floor as you and yours claim this place tonight. The second you walk by, I hit you with sexy eyes. You look through me as if I wasn't right.
Oh no, you didn't. You didn't just walk through. It's time to break it down so you know I'm after you.
When I come creeping up behind you, that's me, your feeling. Hands locked and knocked and pushed,
Hello, everyone. Welcome again to the Mad Monster Party here in Charlotte. This is Drew Badger, and I am talking with a local, well, actually an internationally known legend in the haunt and horror field. You may know him primarily as the tall, thin man in the Phantasm series, but he's done an awful lot of other things, got some stuff coming up very, very soon that you can look at and watch, DVD theaters and all that. Mr. Angus Scrimm, how are you doing today at the Mad Monster Party?
Badger, do you hear that background noise? That's the crowd that's attending the big horror festival here today. And the Mad Monster Party.
There's been an awful lot of folks out here. It's been fantastic. This is day three. Friday night, you had lines out the door. Saturday, you had lines out the door. Sunday, you have been meeting and greeting. We just kind of opened the doors a little while ago. The fans are trilling in, and you've been signing autographs, meeting fans. How has Charlotte treated you so far since you've been here?
I can't tell you how heartwarming and how exciting it is to meet so many terrific people, all warm-hearted, all enthusiastic, from all over North and South Carolina and Tennessee and Texas and Massachusetts. And I even met a chap today from Iceland who flew in specifically for the Mad Monster.
That's unbelievable. I've seen people or met people from Brazil, probably close to at least a dozen states. So obviously, you know, the appearance of Angus Scrimm in a Mad Monster Party is a big event. People come all the way from Iceland for that. Tell us a little bit how you got started in the business and how you kind of worked up into this career that you've had.
Well, when I was a babe in arms, my mother used to take me to the silent movie theaters and sit in the darkness and nurse me while she watched the movie. So I think I associated movies with being fed, and consequently that was what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. So when I graduated from high school back in the middle of World War II, I went straight out to California and have been ever since trying to scratch out the beginnings of a career in Hollywood.
Well, it appears you've scratched out quite a career in the horror industry. I mean, obviously, Phantasm and all the subsequent sequels have been just big hits. You were in Wishmaster, you were in, you know, Chopping Mall, Witch's Brew, lots of different horror movies. You even got more stuff coming out. How did you get associated in the horror movies? I mean, is that something, you hear a lot of stories about actors getting their start, going through, like, low-budget horror movies before hitting it big. Or did you hit it big as a horror actor first, or did it just kind of fall into that way?
I had gotten sidetracked into writing. I used to do the what they call liner notes, the information on the backs of LP and jackets and CD booklets. And then I got involved in co-editing a magazine called Cinema with a young man named Curtis Hanson. Curtis has gone on to become a very famous Hollywood director of films like the Oscar-winning L.A. Confidential and 8 Mile with Eminem and any number of other great pictures. And Curtis cast me in his first film, produced by Roger Corman, called Sweet Kill. And it was a kind of horror film about a serial killer played by Tab Hunter. So that was my entree. And about a year or two after that, I met a young guy named Don Coscarelli, who was only 18, 19 years old and was producing his first film that he had co-written and co-directed. And he cast me as the drunken father in a picture called Jim the World's Greatest. And then, 2 or 3 years later, wrote the part of the tall man for me in Phantasm.
And it just kind of skyrocketed from there. You seem to be associated more with the horror genre than anything else at this point.
Well, Phantasm was an unexpected success all over the world, a big, big moneymaker and a big, big hit with horror fans in every niche of the world. So we subsequently, as you know, did 3 more Phantasms, and out of that came in invitations from filmmakers like the incomparable Jim Wynorski and the Fangoria people, Steve Barnett, and Christopher Coppola, and even J.J. Abrams, the incredible J.J. Abrams, invited me to be in the Alias series with a new young actress named Jennifer Garner, who was brilliant.
She's had a good bit of a career so far.
Oh, not what she deserves. She's a terrific actress and a hard worker and a delight to work with. But anyway, Phantasm spawned everything else that's happened since, I would say.
Does it bother you that you've kind of been typecast in horror films? I know that, you know, some people worry that, you know, well, if I play this character, I'm only going to be known as this character forever. And has that ever bothered you, or have you really kind of exploited that and capitalized on that?
I think everyone from Vincent Price to Christopher Lee, generally feel that they would love to be to display their versatility a little more, and I would love to do more comedy, drawing room comedy, outright farce, anything at all. It's just as much fun to hear people roar with laughter in a theater as it is to hear them scream at horror film.
So any comedy writers out there looking for a different typecast for your next picture, please contact Angus Scrimm.
Absolutely. I'm waiting.
So I understand you have a couple of projects coming out. Can you tell us about those and when we can expect to see those?
I think everybody's heard by now about Don Coscarelli's exciting new film called John Dies at the End, about a couple of young guys who discover a new drug known on the street as soy sauce that projects you into other dimensions. It stars two charismatic new young actors named Chase Williamson and Rob Mays, and the great Paul Giamatti and Doug Jones and any number of fine actors. I've seen clips from it. It was a hit at Sundance Film Festival. It was a hit at the South by Southwest Festival 3 weeks ago in Austin, Texas, and I'm hoping Don will be able to have it out there by the end of 2012 or early in 2013. Then Camden Toy and Bill Moseley and the great Tony Todd and Linnea Quigley and Brink Stevens, all of the horror film industry, all of us are, and Debbie Rochon, are all together in a picture called Disciples, written and produced and directed by a man named Joe Hollow, about the colony of associate devils of Lucifer.
Huh.
And the struggle, the internecine struggles among them for supremacy and greater power. It's going to be quite an exciting film with some dark humor as well as scares.
And the name of that film again is?
The Disciples.
The Disciples. Will that be coming out in the theaters or will that be a DVD?
No, one never knows when you make an independent film exactly what its fate's going to be. So at this point, it's still in post-production and does not have a distributor, but one always hopes for a major studio to say, aha, here's a multi-million dollar moneymaker, let's distribute it.
Well, I see you've got a card here with some big names, Michael Berryman and Debbie Rochon and yourself, for Satan Hates You. What is this that you have on your table here?
Satan Hates You is a movie just fresh out on DVD, which is a kind of loving satire of the old Christian scare flicks that used to be made in the 1970s by small religious film companies, which were designed to depict the terrible evils of drug abuse and fornication to lure and frighten young people, teenagers, into forsaking the evil way and joining the path of righteousness.
Growing up Catholic, I remember a few of those from my youth. Oh, my. And here I am at a horror movie convention talking to the tall man.
Right. Well, this is done lovingly. There's humor in it. It is frightening. It is a bit upsetting in some points. But I think you'll find it fascinating, and it's probably on. It's on Netflix now, and it's in your video dealer shop. So I think you'll find it fascinating. Satan Hates You by Jim McKinney, James Felix McKinney.
Well, Angus Grimm, it has been an absolute delight and a pleasure to speak with you. I know I picked you up from the airport on Thursday night, and we went driving all over Charlotte late night looking for a hamburger and wound up spending the time at a sports bar with scantily clad waitresses and just having a great old time, lovingly conversation. It is an absolute delight to have you here at the Mad Monster Party. We hope you'll be around for Mad Monster Party 2, 3, 4, 5, however many we have, because you have been one of the most popular guests here. I've seen nothing but lines at your table. I'm going to let you get back to meeting your fans here. Again, an absolute joy and a pleasure to speak to you, Mr. Angus Grimm. Any last words you'd like to give to your fans out there?
God bless you all, and Badger, thank you so much. This has been fun.
Absolutely. Once again, Drew Badger here, live at the Mad Monster Party in Charlotte, and I am out.
Hey, kids, Lillaby the Clown here from Nightmare New England and Lillaby the Clown Show. You're listening to the Big Scary Show.
Greetings, mortals, and anything else listening. Drew Badger here with this edition of Deadline News. Deadline News is going to be a bit condensed this week, as all four of our hosts are heading to Columbus and the Midwest Haunters Convention to gather all the latest news and information directly from the vendors and haunters themselves. We're going to have a lot of exciting things to report on coming up within the next few episodes, so stay tuned. We have big news from the Netherworld Haunted Attraction in Atlanta. They've announced the theme of their 2012 main show, Banshee. The ancient evil city of Ease has risen from the ocean and off the coast of Ireland, bringing with it a plague of banshees. These foul, eyeless, winged monstrosities feed on the dark energy of dying humans, seeking battlefields and natural disasters where life hangs in the balance. Where there is no death and war, they create their own by releasing mind-shattering howls that summon evil from the netherworld. Thus, the wail of the banshee has always meant death to those who hear it, as it rips apart the wall between worlds and releases monstrous Fomorian warriors and other Celtic beasts to plunder and destroy. Drawn by the flickering pumpkins and falling leaves of the autumn season, the banshees circle ever nearer, destined to create the most terrifying Halloween the world has ever seen. New features for 2012 include the massive bloody crawling eye, crushed by the primordial giant, portraits of the undying, the slime crawler, mauled by crows, the underwater city, the beast from the abyss, mermaids and tritons, the Fomorian hordes, the wail of the banshee, the house of the dead, the 21-foot-tall tree beast, the moray pits. Feel the horrors of a Halloween gone mad as the sunken city rises and banshees fill the skies. More repulsive monsters, shocking scares, and wild special effects than you have ever seen. Banshee, its scream means death. Netherworld has also announced the theme for their downstairs show for 2012, The Hive. During the height of the Cold War in 1962, Robert Wellington Hughes, a filthy rich genetics researcher, sealed up his staff and followers in an underground bunker called The Hive. Eager to recreate a utopian society and a radiation survival vaccine based on insect DNA, he disappeared beneath the Earth for almost 50 years. Now, when we have discovered his horrifying plot to mutate all mankind into insect-based life forms and to destroy all who dare resist him, you and your team must descend into The Hive and discover the awful truth. New features for 2012 include: the twisted gore in the dark basement of Netherworld grows even more vile with an invasion of giant bugs. Can you face the bone-snapping Crimson Hulk, the colossal writhing centipede, the flesh shredder, wasp warriors, the unstable Cobalt 99 missile, cocooned horrors, giant spiders, live arthropods, attacking maggots, the hideous human blob, and more crawling, skittering, bloody insect nightmares than you can imagine.
For more information about Netherworld's 2012 season, visit fearworld.com.
We have a bit of sad news about Dream Reaper's haunted attraction in Chicago. They've announced this season will be their final year of being Chicago's most horrifying haunted house. They have been rated the number one haunted house in Illinois for several years that they've been open. So if you've ever debated about whether or not you are brave enough to visit Dream Reaper's, this is the year to do so. They promise to put on a show you will never forget. For more information, visit dreamreapers.com. And finally, we have news from the Horror Fields haunted attraction in Sawmills, North Carolina. 2012 is a big year. According to Mayan prophecy, 2012 is the end of the world. We're seeing riots in the streets, Mother Nature is rebelling against humanity, there are even reports of zombies among us. Well, if the end of the world is coming, we at Horror Fields want to go out with a bang. Horror Fields' theme for the 2012 season is titled, It's the End of the World as We Know It. They are the only haunted attraction in the United States that's brave enough to face the end of the world with smiles on their painted faces and a song in their bloody hearts. They plan on showing the world a wide variety of ways the world could end within the confines of their 7 acres of cornfields and woods. No haunt does things like Horror Fields. They're also reporting that they've expanded their calendar to 15 days this year, and they're refusing to raise their prices. As they say, we are making a stand against the rising prices at restaurants, at the movies, everywhere you go for entertainment. We're giving you more horror, and even giving you the chance to save off the price of admission with coupons being available at more places this year. So for more information, visit them on the web at horrorfields.com, or look them up on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter. Remember, folks, as REM once said, it's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine. Remember, if you have any information in the haunt, horror, or Halloween industry, please email it to us at news@bigscaryshow.com, and we'll get it on the air. This concludes this edition of Deadline News.
Broadcasting to you from the darkest reaches of the earth, this is The Haunt Minute. And now, with this week's commentary, Storm.
Alright, over the years, the origins of the zombie apocalypse have evolved. You know, starting out from the beginning, a returning probe from Venus and outer space, and comets and just whatever you're afraid of, you know, radiation, concepts of society, and it's gone through with viruses, which is the present day big threat. It's also now evolved to the biggest thing that scares me, the Bath and Body Shop. You ever gone in one of those places? Pretty creepy. They're always out there giving you stuff to smell. Their sales don't make sense. If you buy 3 of these, you get 2 of these at half the price of 4 of those. If you do that, and you can mix and match, but only from the things in that thing, which have sort of expired, and here's some alcohol with some glitter in it for you to rub on your hands. Frightening to me! And they're the cause of the zombie apocalypse now. That's right. Did you see what's happening in Miami? They make some sort of methamphetamine out of bath salts that you find, you know, at the Bath and Body Shop, and they run around eating each other's faces. That's zombies. The cops couldn't take the guy down. Had to shoot him several times. I don't even know. They haven't gone into details. I think if they tell you there was a headshot that took the guy down, there'd be mass panics. And guess what? It's not an isolated incident. These bath salts are making zombies all over the place. So gear up, the zombie apocalypse is here, and it's starting in the mall, not outside of it, like in the movies. So until next time, keep every minute scary.
Get your Stormy Rant Fix in 140 characters on Twitter at Big Scary Storm.
Are you feeling just a little bit crazy? Are you looking for the right costume to match that craziness? then you need to go to Von Caron Productions and check out The Insane Ensemble. If you've got a mad scientist who's ready to start working on a monster, you've got to check out The Psychosurgical Coat. If you're ready just to start butchering people up, they've got a dissection smock. Or if you think you're just a little bit too crazy and need to be restrained, how about a commitment coat? Von Caron Productions and The Insane Ensemble. Committed to haunters who expect quality. And remember, Halloween is but once all year. Von Caron Productions. Check them out at www.voncaron.com. That's VONCHARON, Von Caron Productions.
Verse 13. Verse 13. The Asylum Speaks. The Asylum Speaks. On the Big Scary Show. Big Scary Show.
Everybody out there, Drew Badger once again live at the Mad Monster Party here in Charlotte, North Carolina. And of all the people that we have interviewed and all the people we're going to yet interview, this man right here absolutely needs no introduction, but I'm going to give you one anyway. He has been a internationally known movie star. He has been a bodybuilder. He has been an actor and just done everything under the sun you can imagine. He runs the circuit now with the conventions, is busier than he has ever been, and was awarded an MBE by the Royal Family of England. This is none other than the man known as the Dark Lord of the Sith, Darth Vader, Mr. David Prowse. How are you doing this evening, sir?
I'm very, very well. Tired after a long flight, but other than that, I'm fine.
I can imagine crossing the Atlantic, in 9 hours or so?
9 hours, yeah.
9 hours. Ugh.
Couldn't do it. Oh, I haven't done it in many, many years. Again, welcome to Charlotte. Welcome to the Mad Monster Party. How has Charlotte treated you so far?
Well, very nice so far. I mean, a lovely hotel, a beautiful hotel, lovely, lovely, lovely room. Met some very nice people.
Excellent.
Couldn't be better.
And I understand you have spent some time in North Carolina in the past.
In the past, yes. I used to spend quite a bit of time in the Wilson area. I used to come into Wilson via Raleigh-Durham and things like this, and did all sorts of promotional work around that area.
Very interesting, because I grew up in the Wilson area. Yeah, I have an awful lot of family in Wilson, so we can talk barbecue and fishing anytime. Tell us a little bit how you got started in this. I know that when you were younger, you got into bodybuilding and you got into working out and you started competing and things. Did that lead into your acting career, or were you already acting and then just kind of started into the bodybuilding?
The acting came totally out of the blue. It's something I never, ever aspired to be. You know, I never aspired to be an actor, and acting as such really never interested me all that much. But I had a sort of a varied career. But I really was, as a young guy, I was absolutely besotted with bodybuilding, and all I ever wanted to do was get into the Mr. Universe contest, which I, after about 10 years training, I eventually got into the Mr. Universe contest. I started training when I was 15. I was 6'5" and weighed about 150 pounds.
Wow!
And I was in a leg iron as well. I was in a leg brace. And I got rid of the leg brace, and they said, well, start doing some exercises to build yourself up. And things just snowballed and snowballed and snowballed. And I eventually got to the stage where I got invited to enter the... I got up to about 240 pounds, 6'7", and I got invited to enter the Mr. Universe contest, which is the biggest contest in the world.
Sure. Like, you know. What year was that?
1980.
Wow. And, I'm assuming you grew up watching people like Charles Atlas, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Lou Ferrigno.
Well, Arnold's a great friend, and Lou's a great friend. I was actually before them.
Right.
You know, they came into the scene later on, you know. Anyway, I entered the Universe contest, and at the end of the competition, the chief of the judges came up, and he said, Davey, I've got some bad news for you. And I said, what's that? He said, you will never, ever win this competition. I said, well, I can't see why not. I said, I'm the biggest competitor you've ever had. I'm 6'7", and I'm sort of knocking on the sort of 270 pounds, like, you know. And I said, I can obviously get a lot bigger. He said, well, no, it's got nothing to do with your physique. I said, well, what's the problem? He said, you've got ugly feet. And I said, well, I can't do anything about my feet. I can't train with feet, like, you know. He said, if it comes to a decision between two physiques of equal standing, he said, the judges will nitpick, and they'll take one look at your feet and your hammer toes and your bunions and things like this, and they'll knock you down. So I thought, well, if this was what bodybuilding is all about, I'll change. And so I turned over to competitive weightlifting. I was getting quite strong at the time, and then within 2 years, I became the British heavyweight weightlifting champion, and I did that in 19. Gosh, I got to think now, because I'm going back a bit. I did the Universe contest in 19. I think. Anyway, I did the Universe contest, and then I changed over. Then I became the British heavyweight weightlifting champion, and then I was a British champion in 1960. Yeah, that's right. It was 1960 was the Universe contest. Sorry, not 1980. It was 1960, and then 61 I got third place in the British weightlifting championships. 62 I won it. And I became the British heavyweight weightlifting champion, and I went to Australia for the Empire Games, and I went to Budapest for the World Weightlifting Championships. Wow. And then 63, I won it again. And then 64, I won it again. And then 64, we were all training to go to Tokyo for the Olympic Games. And I qualified, and I'd been selected for the team, and at the very last minute, we were all ready to go to Tokyo for the Games. And the Weightlifting Association got in touch and said, terribly sorry, Dave, we haven't got enough money to send a complete team to Tokyo. So the heavyweight stands least chance of getting anywhere. So unfortunately, you won't be going.
Wow.
So I thought, well, there's no point. I'm not going to sort of train for another 4 years and hope that I'm going to get selected for the next games. So I thought, I'll turn professional and see what happens. Because I had no specific ideas other than running gymnasiums. I was doing lots of gymnasium work at the time. And And I was working for an American weight training company, the Weider organization,
Joe
which is
Weider's.
Very famous over here. Sure. Like, you know, and I was their European sales manager, and I used to travel around all over London area, trying to sell supplements and weights and barbells and dumbbells and equipment into the gymnasiums and to private people. And one of the gymnasiums I used to call on was run by a guy called Rube Martin, who was a very famous English bodybuilder. And he was a great friend of mine, like, and he said to me one day, he said, we've got a stunt agency attached to the gymnasium here. He used to run this gymnasium called the Mayfair Gym. And he said, we've got a stunt agency attached to the gym. It's called Tough Guys. And he said, if ever there was any work in show business, he said, would you be interested? I said, excuse me. I said, no, I'm not an actor. I've never done any acting. I've never had any acting training and things like this. He said, no, don't worry about this. He said, we'll cross this hurdle when we get to it. He said, there could be a niche for you in show business.
Sure.
I said, in what way? And he said, we get loads of people coming to get in touch with the agency, and they want a big guy. But at the moment, they've only got a choice. If they want a big guy, they've only got a choice of either an ex-boxer or an ex-wrestler.
Right.
And he said, the boxers have got their noses splashed all over their faces. Like, you know, and the wrestlers have got these terrible cauliflower ears.
Right.
And he said, you've come along. He said, you're 6'7". And he said, you're nearly 280 pounds, like, you know. And he said, you've got a great physique. And he said, and you're reasonably good looking. And he said,
feet.
He said, nobody's going to look at your feet. I said, fine, lovely. I said, if anything crops up, you know, let me know. And within,
he thinking like stunt work?
No,
playing the heavies?
Well, the heavies primarily, okay, yeah, sure. But within a couple of weeks, I got a phone call saying, could I get round to the Mermaid Theatre in London? And it was run by a guy called Bernard Miles, who had been gently named Sir Bernard Miles, who was a very famous actor stroke director. And I went around to see him, and he said, well, we've got this play here called Don't Let Summer Come. And the big finale of the play is that we're waiting, the main actor in the play, there's only three people in the play, there's Kenneth Griffith, Liz Fraser, and Caroline Mortimer. And the two girls who worked on him all the way through the play,
right.
And he's eventually led on a bed, waiting for death to take him away. You see, and so we said we need an actor to play the part of death. You see,
oh wow!
And he said, but what we need? He said, it's very specific what we need. And he said, he's going to be led flat on the bed, all wrapped up in red velvet, and we want him to levitate. You see, and he said we've done all sorts of different things, and we've tried all sorts of different ways of doing it. And he said, the poor actor has been dropped about six or seven times already. And he said, we're torn with the idea of giving it up. And he said, would you think you could do it? And I said, yeah, of course I could do it quite easily. I'm not the British heavyweight weightlifting champion for nothing, like, you know. So he said, well, we'd like to see. So they led him on this bed, and I went over and scooped him up and sort of held him up. I said, where would you like him like this? You see? And they said, whoop, could you do that twice nightly? And I said, if you pay me enough money, I'll tell you as many times a night as you like. You see? And that got me into the play. And through getting into the play, that got me into the Actors Union, which was a big thing. That was a very big thing. Because at that time, you couldn't get into the union unless you had a job. And you couldn't get a job unless you were a member of the union. It was a ridiculous situation.
Sure.
Yeah. Anyway, it got me into the Actors Union. I did the play, and then everything sort of snowballed from there on. It's like the agent guy who ran the gymnasium kept on sending me up for odd bits and pieces of work. You know, they're all small stuff.
Sure.
You know? But then gradually,
but work is work.
But yeah, yeah. But then gradually the parts got better and better and better. And then I said, I suppose for me, the parts culminated with. I think it was 1970, and I got offered Stanley Kubrick got in touch. What happened? I got a phone call from Stanley Kubrick, I got a phone call from his secretary from his office, and I said, Mr. Kubrick would very much like to see you, and can you come to his house? So I said, yeah, we'd love to. He said, well, he's working on this movie. He's working on Clockwork Orange at the moment. And he's tied up all, you know, at the studios. He said, the best time to come up would be come up like 7 o'clock of an evening. Come out to the house. Well, it was about a 2-hour drive from where I lived. I chased all the way out there and sort of sat around and I waited. And it got to about 9:30. Still no sign of Stanley coming in. You see, then a phone call comes through and says, terribly sorry, Mr. Kubrick is detained on set. I can't see you, you say. So can you make another appointment, you say. So I made another appointment for the following day, and exactly the same thing happened. Chased all the way out there. It took me 2 hours to drive up to his house. Sat around, waited and waited and waited, and once again the message came through saying, terribly sorry, Mr. Kubrick is detained on set. And they said, can you make another appointment? You see, and I thought, I was there M and an I, and like, you know, they said, can you make it at your convenience? You know? I thought, well, the only time he's not going to be working will be 7 o'clock on a Sunday night. He won't be working Sunday night, you see. And I said, I'll come up on Sunday evening. And they said, that's fine, lovely, lovely. And got there on the Sunday night, and there was Stanley there waiting for me, like, you know. And I went there, and I had a nice chat with him, And he said, "Well, this is I'm doing this film." And he said, "There's a lovely part in it for you, playing the Julian, who's the bodyguard to the writer." He said, "There's two major scenes in it that we would like you to do, and one is where you've got to carry Alex down the stairs, mm-hmm. and another one later on, where you'll be working with the writer, Patrick McGee." And anyway, so that got me into Clockwork Orange.
And Clockwork Orange turned into such a cult film.
Well, the thing is that all of a sudden, because I'd worked for Stanley Kubrick, I suddenly became Dave Prowse's actor, and I was no longer the heavy and the monster and the creature and all these things that I'd been doing. I was Dave Prowse's actor, and then as luck would have it. The film came out very briefly in 1970, I think we did it in 70, and it came out very, very briefly in like 71, I think it was, and then Stanley started getting all these death threats, and everybody was threatening to kill him because everybody thought this movie was so bad, you know.
Right. It was not without its controversy.
It was all the sex and violence.
Of course. Which, you know, nowadays it's almost considered tame, but back then it was.
Yeah, well, it was really tough.
Very, very.
Anyway, what happened? Stanley got fed up with all this, and they said, "That's it. I'm going to take it off the circuit. Nobody will ever see it again." Mm. And they didn't until he died. And the day after he died, the movie
there
was out.
As it was.
But in that short period that it was on the show, which is like 71, 72, that sort of period. In the short period it was out, George Lucas saw it, and next thing I know, when I get an invite to. I heard the managing director of 20th Century Fox called me up, and so I said, somebody who I knew actually, and he said, "Oh, Dave," he said, I got this young guy came over from America, and they're setting up a film, at L3 Studios, and he very much wants to see you," he said. And I said, "Oh, that's interesting. What's the situation?" He said, "Well, I don't know much about it." He said, "But he definitely wants to see you. And would you like to come to the 20th Century Fox offices up in Soho Square in London?" So I went up to these beautiful offices where 20th Century were, and I got ushered in, and I'm trying to introduce to George, who looks like some young student, like, you know. And he takes me into the room, and it's got all these conceptual drawings all the way around the room. And he said, "I'm making this film called Star Wars," and he said, "And these are all the conceptual drawings about different scenes in the movie and things like this, you know." And he said, "I'd like to offer you one of two parts in the movie." I thought, "Blimey, I'm being offered one of two parts."
Not even auditioning.
Mm. He said, "I said, excuse me, if you don't mind me asking," I said, "How did you know of me?" I said, "Because, you know, all my work is in the UK." I said, "And you're obviously coming over from California." I said, "And I've never done any Hollywood movies or anything else." He said, "Dave," he said, "I saw you in Clockwork Orange." He said, "If you're good enough for Stanley Kubrick, you're good enough for me." And that was it. And then I said, "Well, what are the two parts?" He said, "Well, the first one's a character called Chewbacca." And I said, "What in the hell is Chewbacca?" And he says, "Like a hairy gorilla that goes through the film on the side of the goodies." And all I could think of was like 3 months in a gorilla skin, hot and sweaty and smelly, what that was all going to be. And I said, "No, I don't fancy that very much, George." I said, "What's the other one?" He said, "Well, the other one's the big villain of the film." And I said, "Don't say any more, George. I'll have the villain's part." And he said, "Well, tell me for why." I said, "Well, you think back on all the movies that you've ever seen where there are goodies and baddies." I said, "You always remember the bad guy."
Very true.
And he said, "Dave," he said, "nobody will ever forget Darth Vader." And here we are.
35 years later.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. And that's basically how it all started. That's how it all started. And then, of course, you know, through Clockwork Orange, enabled me, not Clockwork Orange, through Star Wars, enabled me to do all sorts of different things. I became I also became the figurehead of the British government's road safety campaign for children.
You became the Green Cross code man.
Yeah, that ran for 14 years. Yeah, 14 years I did that.
It never ran in the States then.
No, no, it was an English campaign because it was just teaching children how to cross roads safely, you know, to, you know, not to run out in front of the cars and to watch traffic as you stand.
Were you more of a superhero type character?
Yeah, like Superman.
That. Okay.
Yeah, I had this beautiful green suit and a green and white suit. And but what happened was, We did three commercials a year for 5 years. That was from 76 through to 80. And then from 80 to 90, I did nothing else but go around the schools. I did 10 years of, and I used to do three schools a day, 5 days a week, for the entire school period.
Probably hit every school in Britain.
I loved every minute of it. I've always said it's the greatest job I ever had. And
think of all the lives you've probably saved.
I'll tell you how many. We actually did a reckon up of it because when the road safety campaign started, the accident figures in Great Britain were running at 40,000 a year.
Wow.
40,000 children a year were getting knocked down, injured and killed on the roads. When we finished the campaign, we reduced it to 20,000. We halved the number of kids. And if you added it all up over the 14 years that we were doing it, it actually worked out that we actually saved over 250,000 children's lives. And then in the year 2000, I got awarded the MBE from the Queen.
I was going to ask if Green Cross Codeman led you to be getting an MBE.
MBE. Got awarded the MBE, which is a member of the Order of the British Empire.
That's not the same as being knighted, is
no,
it?
No, that's
but it's a similar
it's
type of award.
It's actually the lowest.
Oh, okay.
Virtually the lowest of the awards. You get the MBE, then you get the OBE, and you get the CBE, and then you get into the things like knighteds and things like this, you know, lords and ladies.
You still have time to work your way through the ranks.
Yeah,
you might get a Sir David Prowse before it's all said.
There's lots of things happening at the moment. I mean, I'm now at the present moment. I'm plastered all over the buses, on the backs of buses. And also my picture's gone up in all the Marks and Spencer stores, you know, which is one of the biggest chain stores in Great Britain, and I'm the sort of figurehead now of the Prostate Cancer Awareness Month,
right?
And so all my pictures are up all over the country. People are ringing me up saying, "Oh, I saw your picture on the back of a bus, Dave."
Like, so maybe some of the children that you saved back in the 70s and 80s, you're now saving from prostate cancer.
Yeah, it's amazing. And then I got another one. I launched a new road safety campaign for young drivers. I mean, I did that recently, there's another one coming up. I'm from Bristol. My home is in Bristol, and they're now having what they call a Bristol Walk of Fame, and they've inducted I think about 25 or 30 people, very famous, you know, like I mean going way back, people like that. In British history, like you probably a lot of people that you wouldn't remember, you wouldn't know of. But Isambard K. Brunel, for instance, who was the big shipbuilder and engine builder and train builder, and these he was inducted into this
right.
thing. And they have these blue plaques now, which they're putting up all over. In Bristol, we have one of the greatest zoos in the world, and it's a beautiful, lovely botanical gardens and things like that, you know. And they're putting all these plaques up to all these famous people, and I'm being inducted into
one
of the famous Bristolians. I think it's in April.
So you will live in infamy.
Live in infamy, yeah.
Congratulations on that.
Yeah, sorry.
So you said that one of your greatest achievements was Green Cross Code Man. Mm-hmm. That was, you know, the thing that children loved you. You had commercials and all that. Were there any things that you regretted doing? I know you did all the Hammer's House of Horror films. Mm-hmm. I know those were great. You were Frankenstein a few times. You played heavy. You were even on Benny Hill.
They were lovely. I never regretted anything.
Okay. I know that sometimes actors, if they're in a slump or something, they'll take a job, and then they'll say 10, 20 years later, I wish I'd never done that job.
I've never felt that way at all.
How did you like doing those House of Horrors?
Oh, loved it. Loved every minute of it. Yeah. They're great fun. Great fun to do. Working with Hammer, it was like working with a family business. And you were sort of welcomed into the family business, as it were. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
And now you primarily do the convention circuit. You travel around the countries and the world.
I'm involved with lots of different charities.
Sure.
I do a lot of charity work. So I'm involved with the Prostate Cancer Charity. I'm vice president of the Physically Handicapped and Able Bodied Association, which is what they call FAB, which is a charity for arthritis people, arthritics. There's all sorts of other different charities. I was doing some charity work with the Reeve Irvine Institute for Stem Cell Research, because of Christopher Reeve, because of my association with Christopher Reeve.
You were friends with him. You trained him for Superman, I believe.
I built him up for the role of Superman. I put 40 pounds on him in 6 weeks.
Wow.
So that he looked reasonably when he went into his Superman suit. Yeah, that was an interesting experience.
I can imagine. Yeah, he put 40 pounds on something. I need to lose 40 pounds. That's my problem.
Just serious training, just knowing how to train somebody.
Right.
And how to go about it in the right way and not waste time doing exercises you don't need to do, but working on all the major muscle groups. And the other thing is this: it's not only the training, but it's also the feeding as well. You've got to get your food intake right so the muscle development can happen.
I know you've had a few medical issues over the past few years. Do you still work out and still keep yourself well trained? I mean, you look great for a man in his 70s.
76. Yeah, 77 this year. Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah. So I said to my wife yesterday, she said, I was having a bit of an argument with her, and she said, and I said, I don't think you appreciate what I do, what I'm up to and what I'm doing. And she said, Dave, I don't know anybody of your age that's doing the amount of traveling you do and the amount of work you do and the way you do it and all this sort of business. And she said, no, I'm full of admiration for you. Oh, thank God for that. Yeah.
And you've been married for a long time.
50 years next year.
Congratulations.
Yes, 2013, we celebrate our golden wedding anniversary.
In the age where Hollywood marriages seem to last, two or three years at best, and that's an old couple there. Is that different in the film industry in England? Do couples stay married longer there, or is it kind of similar to Hollywood?
No, I think with all Hollywood romance or film romances, things are great for the short period that you're working with them, and then I think things go very, very cold when you get to the cold light of day and you're together and things are not going too well. For instance, you're not working
right.
There's a complete difference between when you're happy and you're working, or you're both working and you're both earning, and then all of a sudden the work dries up.
And that's the risk any actor has.
Then it causes a few problems. Yeah.
Ever since I found out you were coming to this convention, I've wanted to ask you this question. What was it like working with Benny Hill, who was one of my absolute favorites? And probably the very first time I ever saw you on TV was the infamous Wishing Well sketch. Absolutely.
That sketch is actually the most famous Benny Hill sketch of the lot, of all the sketches he's ever done. It was the most famous. And they used that one to sell the Benny Hill show all around the world, yeah. And I'm continually getting residuals coming in from that.
Very nice.
And not very much. You don't get much.
No, I understand.
But you've got sales from the Benny Hill sketch to Borneo, for instance, of all places. Yeah. And you find your $2 or something like that.
Sure.
You get something. It's only very minor. But you've got these great long invoices, of all these different places that have had the Benny Hills.
And it's fascinating to just see the people who are buying and where you're actually selling. That's got to be amazing.
But I thoroughly enjoyed working with him. He was very nice. I worked with him several times. I did another one where I was a jogger, and I was having trouble with my girlfriend in the scene. That was another nice little one I did with them. Morecambe and Wise as well. They were very famous, probably even more famous than Benny Hill in Great Britain. They were the biggest duo.
Right.
That we had, yeah.
I used to watch on Sunday evenings. They used to have a whole night of British comedy. They used to have the two Ronnies. They used to have Benny Hill. They used to have Monty Python. The ones that people know. Doctor in the House and all that. And I've always loved British comedy. Mm-hmm. It's a very unusual type of dry wit and great humor and a lot of what I like to call intellectual humor too. And Benny Hill was just kind of the antithesis of all that. He was just like hot chicks in bikinis and chasing women in lingerie. That's why I love that show as well. Yeah. And of course, I'm 9 years old and watching that on TV with eyes as big as saucers.
He was great fun to work with. I enjoyed it very much so.
Well, Mr. Prowse, it has been an absolute golden pleasure and opportunity to speak with you. I enjoyed picking you up at the airport. Sorry I was a few minutes late. I got That's tied right, up with the TSA people and parking issues and all that. I wish you nothing but success, especially with, you know, the con. I'm sure there's going to be just thousands of people here lining up to talk with you about various, you know, shows, whether it's the horror movies, Frankenstein's, or that sci-fi thing you made back in the 70s that caught on a bit. And I hope you sell lots of merchandise. Your campaigns for prostate cancer and the other charities that you work with.
That's the big thing, actually, it's enabled me to do all sorts of different things. You know, the Star Wars has been a great fillip to my career, as it were.
You know, probably get more residuals from that than Benny Hill, maybe just a few.
You don't. I mean, the residuals are very few and far between. You know,
really,
that died out years ago. Yeah,
hmm.
It enables you to. Do all sorts of different things, and it enables me to get involved in lots of different charity work, which is what I love doing. I love getting involved.
Without getting too much into Star Wars, did you like the recent first three movies that came in that kind of led up to you?
No, I didn't like them at all, actually. I thought there was a terrible difference between. I thought the first 4, 5, and 6, which are the three I was involved in.
Absolutely.
I thought they were great movies. I mean, they were great movies.
And anybody over the age of 30 will probably tell you, and I totally agree with you, that they're absolutely the best.
But the thing was, is that they were very, how can you say, it was like the technology. I mean, we had no technology at the time, like, you know, and it was all done, I won't say on a shoestring, but it was all... Make do and mend, almost, like, you know.
Sure. It was real props and real things, as opposed to this computer generated everything.
And then, of course, what happened then is they went back and decided to do 1, 2, 3. And that was all, well, then, of course, it was all CG and everything else. And I think it ruined it. I think it really, really did ruin them. I don't honestly think that the stories were all that good, not on the first three. This is my personal opinion. When I heard that Vader was going to come back in episode 3, I went out of my way to try and obviously I let Lucas know that I wanted to reprise the role, and I kept getting turned down at every turn, and then eventually they came and said they're terribly sorry, but Hayden Christensen's got it in his contract that he can play Vader. He wants to play Vader. When Vader is a master, not a mask, but when it's revealed,
created, so to speak, in
episode 3. And of course, and the funny thing was, of course, is when they were filming it, they were filming in Australia, and I was in Australia at the time when they were filming it. I didn't like what it looked like. It looked just like a Frankenstein movie. It looked like Frankenstein rising from the, you know, rising up, as it were, you know, from.
Been a lot of comparisons to that. I've heard other people mention that too, especially with you know, the breaking of it, you know, just breaking out and all that.
Well,
very interesting. It's very interesting to hear, you know, especially when there was such a long distance. You know, there was close to 16 years between the movie 6 and movie 1 came out.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, there are always those rumors that there's supposed to be a post trilogy, you know, 7, 8, and 9, mm-hmm. which may or may never ever be made. You know, the books canon and the magazines and everything long has just grown into such a huge thing, and you had such a big part in that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you look back on that and just, you know, swell up with pride sometimes, just thinking, you know, I was a part of arguably the largest franchise in history.
Most definitely. Yeah, I'm very, very, very proud of that.
And voted one of the most recognizable characters on the planet as well.
I now regard it as the ultimate screen villain of all time, which is a lovely accolade to have.
Because everybody remembers the bad guy.
Everybody remembers the bad guy, exactly.
Absolutely. Well, again, Mr. Prowse, it has been an absolute pleasure to speak.
I'm sorry.
Dave, it has been an absolute pleasure to speak with you again for the Big Scary Show. This is our debut episode that we're putting out, and I'm glad you could absolutely be a part of it. I hope you sell just tons of merchandise, meet tons of fans, and I know that Mad Monster Party is going to continue on in the years to come, and I hope you are invited to come back many, many times as well.
Thank you once again.
Thank you. This is Drew Badger live in Charlotte, North Carolina, my hometown, for the Big Scary Show, and I am out.
This is the Hitchhiker. from the Haunting Experience on Highway 61. And if you're not listening to the Big Scary Show, then you might as well be dead on the road.
A Big Scary Show exclusive. Grave Robber, Nightbreed, from the Big Scary Show.
Everybody, you've got Drew Badger live at the Mad Monster Party in Charlotte, North Carolina, here talking to the stars, having a good time for the Big Scary Show's first few issues. And I'm talking to a true star of the stage, the screen, the big screen, the little screen, all screens, even cartoons. I'm talking to the man who was known as Jack Skellington. I'm talking to the man who was known as Humperdinck. I'm talking to the man who's known as J.D. Mr. Chris Sarandon, how are you doing, sir?
I'm doing great, thanks.
Fantastic. Tell us a little bit how you got started in the business. Tell us how you kind of worked your way up the ranks into the star that you are today.
It really began when I was in college. I got involved in an acting class. The professor was encouraging. He asked me to be in a couple of productions, and I fell in love with it, and that was it. That basically began my career in acting. I did a lot of college productions, and I went to graduate school and got a performing arts degree in graduate school, and then went straight to start to work in the professional theater and repertory theater in New Haven, Connecticut. Then I moved to New York, got a quick gig on a soap opera, which paid the rent. And then I got a Broadway show, and from then on, it was sort of, that was the beginning of the career for me. I mean, I'm wrapping up a few years in three sentences, but that's the way it went.
Absolutely. You've been in this a long time. You were in the original Fright Night back in the 80s.
Right.
And in the remake. What were some of the differences in the two, and what were some of the similarities that you liked doing it? Was there like reunions with people you haven't seen in a while? Was the story just so different or similar? What did you think about the difference between working the original and the new?
Well, I thought they really did a nice job of contemporizing it, you know, bringing it up to 2011. The original was made in the 80s. And in a way, the original, which is a wonderful movie and beautifully constructed and I think really well acted by the whole cast. Tom Holland, the director, I think cast the movie really well. It's creaky and a little, you know, it's in certain ways, just because some movies do date themselves. There's a disco scene, for instance, and always disco scenes always date a movie, or a dance hall scene where people are dancing and, you know, it places in a different era.
The soundtrack.
Yeah, exactly. But the one thing about the original that I thought they tried to capture and did, for the most part, did capture in the new, what they call the reimagining, which I think is a better way of describing it than a remake,
sure.
Is that they tried to, and we did as well, mix horror and humor without making fun of the genre. There were movies up until Fright Night was made where the genre was getting a little tired, and so movies started being campy kind of looks at the horror genre. And Fright Night, I think, was one of the first movies, at least certainly of that era, that attempted to look at the conventions of the genre and turn a few of them on their ear, but at the same time respect them, create an atmosphere that was very scary and very enveloping, but at the same time that was funny at the same time, and also had a heart. And I think that's what fans feel very strongly about for the original Fright Night. And I think, to a large part, they accomplished that in the reimagining as well, that it is funny, it's very scary, but they went in a different direction. For instance, the Jerry Dandridge character now, and Colin Farrell and I talked about this, he determined that it was better for him not to try to recreate Jerry, but to make a new Jerry.
Sure.
And so he made him, pardon the pun, very feral, in the sense that he's much more of an animal in his appetites. And he's not such a sophisticated man of the world, kind of, but more a sort of everyday guy.
Sure.
And I like that about the remake, quote-unquote.
And how, back in the 90s, how did you wind up getting approached to do Nightmare Before Christmas? Was this a part that was written with you in mind, or did you have to go through a big audition process? And, you know, we all know that it has been just an absolute cult phenomenon forever. And I'll ask you this question. Why has there not been, or should there ever be, a sequel or some kind of a spinoff to the Nightmare Before Christmas?
Oh, I think it's a great idea for there to be, but I guess, Tim Burton has other things to do. You know, he's busy all the time. He's doing the new Dark Shadows, which I think is coming out fairly soon. I have no idea. I know that Disney has the rights to the project itself. They do all sorts of things with Jack. I do the haunted, whatever they do at Halloween out at Disneyland. I do the voices for that. I do the voices for the ringtones for people, for their telephones, that sort of thing. I don't know. I have no idea why the there hasn't been a sequel, other than the fact that probably Tim has visited it once. I don't know that he necessarily wants to go back and see it again.
Well, I remember things like Beetlejuice had a Saturday morning cartoon for a brief time, and that may have actually, well, I want to say it shallowed
diminished
or heartened or diminished it. Yes, I think Nightmare is such a strong story on its own, it doesn't really need to risk diminishing its impact on everything.
And I think that's a very good point. As to your question about the process of my being involved, basically I just went in and auditioned.
Okay.
So. Danny Elfman had already done the songs. They had been animated, and they were looking for a voice that was at least close enough to Danny so that the transition was seamless.
Didn't sound too different.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. And I guess I fitted the bill. I fit the bill, much to my, you know, I'm thrilled that they thought that my voice was one that matched Danny's, because this has been a great thing for me.
Absolutely. How has the Mad Monster Party, being in its first year, treated you? How have the fans been? How have the crowds been and everything?
Oh, it's been such an enthusiastic reception here. Everybody tells me this is the first time there's been a show like this in Charlotte.
Yes.
The fans seem to be reacting in a very enthusiastic, a very enthusiastic way.
Are you getting more people interested in the Fright Nights or the Princess Brides or any other role? Is there a trend? Or are you seeing people bringing merchandise that you've never seen before, or very fascinating photos or products or anything like that for you to sign and talk about?
Actually, it's interesting because I've done a few of these shows in the past, and there tend to be shows where people are more interested in one movie than another. In this one, it seems to be fairly evenly distributed. There are Princess Bride fans, there are Fright Night fans, there are Child's Play fans. Because there are a couple of other cast members here from Child's Play, and we, in fact, had a Q&A for Child's Play.
I was going to ask you how that went. I saw a huge crowd.
The Q&A was great. We had a really, really nice time, and the fans loved it. So it was great.
Fantastic. What's on the horizon for Chris Sarandon? Anything you're working on coming up that we should look for you?
I have been doing a lot of theater in New York. I finished a movie last year that's being released in the end of April, a Jason Statham action movie called Safe, which will be out, I think, April 27th. I did another film in New England called Frank the Bastard, which is going to be out, I don't know when. It's an independent feature that was shot up there this past summer, spring and summer. I'm sorry, summer and fall. I'm always looking for work, man.
Work is work, as they say.
That's right.
Fantastic. Well, Mr. Sarandon, it's been an absolute pleasure to meet and talk with you. And I hope that today, the last day of the Mad Monster Party, you have hundreds and hundreds of fans coming up, wanting to shake your hand, autograph, and buy merchandise, and talk to you. And once again, I wish you nothing but success. Look forward to seeing Safe, and is it Frank the Bastard?
Frank the Bastard.
Frank the Bastard, coming out in theaters soon. Once again, Chris Sarandon here at the Mad Monster Party in Charlotte, North Carolina. This is Drew Badger, and I am out.
Horror. Metal. Haunting. It's all dark and scary. At Thorn Web Designs, we know what you want, what you need, and we will give you exactly that. Since 2007, we have been providing our customers with the best logos, web designs, and more. We can offer to keep their image dark, scary, and memorable, not to mention fantastic prices. With clients from Nightmare Zone Haunted House and Wells Township Haunted House, we are ready to give you the scope you need for web presence. To get your quote and to browse our portfolio, visit ThornWebDesigns.com.
Greetings, Haunters. Are you ready to face your fears? The Unknown Scare Actor here. Over the weekend, it was my pleasure to tour the Waverly Hills Sanatorium in Louisville, Kentucky for the second time. So what I wanted to talk to you about today is spectrophobia, or the fear of ghosts. Now, Wikipedia generalizes the definition of spectrophobia, and this is what they've got to say. Generally, an individual that deals with spectrophobia has been traumatized in an event where they believe they may have seen or heard apparitions or ghosts. If you got spectrophobia, I don't think you're going to be going to Waverly Hills. The individual also could become traumatized by horror films, television shows, or by nightmares. This fear could be the result of a trauma involving mirrors, and you're like, wine errors. It could be that some people have a superstitious fear of being watched through a mirror, or they may suffer low self-esteem related to their physical appearance and avoid seeing his or her own reflection and therefore avoid mirrors. Hollywood movies relate the supernatural world with mirrors could be a cause for this fear in younger children. But getting back to the spectrophobia, during the tour, you know, I've always been what I like to call a hopeful skeptic when it comes to the supernatural. I've been to Waverly Hills now twice. I've been to other allegedly haunted and paranormal locations. Some things I just could not explain. And I had a rather unusual occurrence while at Waverly Hills. It didn't drum up spectrophobia, but it did make me think. And while I was on the infamous fourth floor doing the walk where you go down the corridor and everybody stays except you and people watch for shadow people, as I was at the corner where they can't see past me, I'm looking down the hallway and I saw something. I don't know what it was. But I do know it wasn't just a play of the light and shadow, because it was moving at a rapid clip towards me. At that point in time, I decided, alright, I don't know what it is or what it isn't, and I don't really want to find out right now. So I took the high road and decided to move back towards my group, just in case it may have been something insidious. Anyway, haunters, that's a fear you might want to think about when you're working in your haunt, or if you're going on a paranormal tour to Waverly Hills or any of the other places such as Mansfield, the Moundsville State Prison in Moundsville, West Virginia. Let's see, what else is out there? Anyway, always remember one thing, haunters. Everyone. Is afraid of something.
Hi, this is Piper, giving you a shout out from the Dead Schoolhouse to the Big Scary Show.
As we slide back into the swamp where we hid the body, we would like to thank the following people and others: Jimmy Talkington and Thornweb Designs, thornwebdesigns.com, Virgil Franklin, Master of the Ether Muse, at hauntaudio.com, Von Caron Productions, Von Caron, VonCharon.com, Screamline Studios, at ScreamlineStudios.com. We'd also like to thank the Four Ghosts, Storm, catch his ramblings at HauntMinute.com, The Unknown Scare Actor, videos and more, UnknownScareActor.com. The Haunt Rocker Jerry Vane. Pick up his latest CD, The Attic, at JerryVane.com. And Drew Badger, actor, trainer, consultant, and more, RabbitBadger.biz. Be sure to tell us what you think. Send feedback to us at feedback@BigScaryShow.com. And keep sending in those news items, news@BigScaryShow.com. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/BigScaryShow. Or on Twitter at BigScaryShow. And you can find us on iTunes. Search Big Scary Show in the iTunes store. Tune in next time when we bring you the latest news and information from the world of haunting and horror. And thank you once again for listening. Without you, we are nothing. Good night, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and others. This is the Big Scary Show.